Hello, welcome to the Twin Perspectives podcast series run by travel bloggers Twins That Travel. That's us,
Claire
and Laura.
Tune in for regular discussions about our latest travels, interviews and life more generally.
Happy listening.
Bye.
Welcome to season 2,
episode 9
of the Twin Perspectives podcast series, coming to you from a more professional environment than we've ever been in, actually, yes. Ever in our lives, here at The Independent in
South Kensington.
And today we are with Simon Calder.
Hello.
Travel journalist extraordinaire.
Available and affordable, I think is the phrase.
Available and affordable.
And we met Simon just a couple of weeks ago, about two, three weeks ago.
Just over 2 weeks ago.
Yes, a fascinating occasion. This was a conference in Norwich, all about how to encourage more people to visit that beautiful city. Mm-hmm. And I think probably I was giving the kind of old school conventional view of the media. And so it's fascinating to find out what Twins That Travel do that's different.
Yeah, and we didn't actually get to stay for the aftermath. Was it interesting after
the aftermath? Oh, crikey.
The blood bath.
Scorched earth. Everyone seemed to go away happy, which is always a good thing.
That's good, yeah. Yes. No, it was a nice event and nice to see Norwich trying to put itself on the map, because I do feel like when we visited, it's one of those cities that goes under the radar a little bit.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
But you did very well. Leave them wanting more, and you scooted off to Northumberland.
We did. It was unbelievably cold. we met a few weeks ago, and we have, well, we know Simon anyway for his work with The Independent, and on This Morning with Holly and Phil. We regularly see you on there. But if you want to give your own introduction, Simon, so that I can,
I think there's perhaps more that we have in common than you might imagine, in the sense that I think Claire and Laura, you and I sort of started doing this because we like travelling and thought, oh, well, this could be an interesting thing to do. So I actually started off by writing guidebooks, nice thing to do, because first of all, it's good fun and you get to go to lots of places and dig around and find dodgy hotels and places to eat where you probably won't get food poisoning. But also you kind of get an idea of bit about writing, because I'm a mathematician by training, I sort of left words behind when I was about 15, and therefore I just sort of did that, and then The Independent very kindly started, and then I did some freelance writing for them, and then somehow got this job 25 years ago, and it's been all downhill since then.
No, it's not.
Writing the... for the travel guides, is it a brand?
Oh, well, yeah, it's a company called Vacation Work, funnily enough, started at pretty much the same time as Lonely Planet. Started ahead of the Rough Guides, but somehow didn't quite keep up. And I've worked for people like AA and so on, so I'll work for anybody on the guidebook front. And they are very, very good to do, because they're very disciplined, so therefore you do have to kind of get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, trudge around 17 churches, 14 museums, 6 different cafes, and have all these experiences, basically so you can appraise them. And I think that's what kind of makes guidebooks still a bit different from things like TripAdvisor, because you've got people who are supposed to be professionally judging them.
Yeah, so you make it sound very easy. You just happen to walk into this job with the guidebooks.
Guidebooks has always traditionally been easy to get into, as long as you don't want to actually make any sensible money. And
okay,
all I
fine.
Wanted to do was kind of just about break even on my on my travelling habit. So that was all. The money was pathetic, but nobody would be doing it for the money. They'd be doing it because they wanted to travel.
Exactly.
And any regrets? Ever want to go back to the mathematics?
Oh, crikey. Well, I taught maths for a while. I think the poor children I taught at a comprehensive in Crawley are very glad that I decided not to do that for too long. No, but I tell you what, when you are doing what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis at The Independent, all to do with travel stories as they're happening, you know, we're speaking here and just as you arrive, Jet Airways, very sadly, the Indian airline collapsed.
Yeah.
Probably the most useful piece of kit that I have is a calculator. Honestly, because if you're trying to make sense of the world, you want to know, for example, how much money Ryanair made per passenger. You don't care about, you know, I don't know what a billion euros looks like, but I do know that you can say they made £7 per person profit, and that means, crikey, they must be a well-run company if they're not charging very much for flying and they're making that much profit. So I still stick to the maths.
It's a good way, and a bit of number crunching in with the travel.
Well, there we are.
All is not lost.
And I know I should probably do it in my head since I purport to be a mathematician, but there we are.
And so you've been within 25 years.
Yeah.
And
How?
As a generation,
is because you just dodge the bullets and and just keep going. And
keep traveling
the good
abroad.
Thing about being a travel correspondent is that nobody quite knows what you do. When you're not here, they kind of think that you're probably away doing something important. And so they don't worry too much about you. If you were, I don't know, the crime correspondent, they'd expect you to be at the Old Bailey every day or on the city desk. You know, you'd be writing all these business stories. But no, I just, so I don't
you're
think
you're in a Lilo somewhere in Gran Canaria. You're up to
doing some good work.
And so that's a myth that I'm quite happy to continue as long as possible.
And how often are you travelling with your role?
Well, that all depends. It's a very odd thing because I think maybe again, like you, Laura and Claire, I'd love to think I have complete control. I want to go here and here and here. This is my list of great places to go and the things I want to do and the people I want to meet and the food I want to eat and the views I want to see. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work like that at all, really, because, for example, as again we speak, Portugal is falling apart. All the planes are running out of fuel, which is annoying if you're on a plane. The cars are going mad. So I may possibly on kind of, you know, tomorrow or the next day, I may possibly go to the Algarve to see what's happening there. But I just don't know. We do at The Independent a number of sponsored projects with other people, which I know you do. So, for example, for the last three winters, and how lucky is this? I get to go to Florida.
Oh, lovely.
And do lots of things, which is good. But again, like you, The Independent says, yep, we're happy to do this, but we retain complete editorial control. Right. So I'm sure they'd like that, me just sort of say, this is great, oh, isn't it marvellous, and so on. But no, I will say it as I find it.
That's definitely something we want to touch on upon later, full editorial control and how that might be different for bloggers.
So I guess your work, similar to ours, is quite reactive then. You kind of want to say, oh, I'm going to go to Taipei, but here I am in the Algarve.
Oh, well, it is and it isn't. So let me tell you what I've got coming up, because those are...
Yeah, that's very exciting.
So, for example, at the end of May, beginning of June, there is for the first time, and this is really significant, a ferry between mainland Turkey and mainland Greece starting up. So, therefore, I'm going to go on the very first sailing, which is great. And that's going to be a really important thing because, as you will know, Greece and Turkey have been really in great conflict for effectively almost a century, maybe a millennium. And therefore, this is a really good signal. But rather than just do that, you know, you need to kind of extract as much as you can from the trip. So I'm going to be flying into Varna on the Black Sea coast, which is where I kind of left off some years ago when I came down the coast from Romania. So I'm going to pick up again, head down the coast to Burgas, somehow get across into Turkey, hopefully get onto a sleeper train going to Izmir and then to the port of Çeşme and get on the ship. And so therefore you can, as you will know, when you're travelling you have adventures and therefore it's a good thing to
do. It does sound like an adventure.
So I will have a fixed point and then lots of things will happen
around it. Make some adventures around it.
So are you able to pitch your own ideas for destinations?
I have to convince my colleagues, in particular Kathy Adams, the head of travel, that there is a good reason for going somewhere, or indeed to the news people. You know, I think this is a really important story, ferry link between Turkey and Greece, and here's what I want to do and here's what you'll get out of it. So yeah, I'm most definitely a supplier to customers rather than just somebody who sits about thinking, oh, I bet it's sunny somewhere, I'll go and have a look.
2 weeks in the Maldives.
And but how does a sponsored work? How is that different then? So you mentioned Visit Florida. How is sponsored work different to you pitching? Do Visit Florida approach you or the PR agency and they want to get you to go out there to cover Florida? When his class is sponsored, what does that mean?
So it's a very good question. It's simply that a number of organisations, and we've worked with tourist boards, airlines, all sorts of people, as you have, they want to promote their part of the world. Mm-hmm. So effectively, we will give our lovely online readers and viewers extra stuff. Mm-hmm. In addition to what they would have.
Okay, so
for which we will maintain complete editorial control. But effectively, the tourist boards are saying, yeah, we'd like to cover some places in Florida, for instance, yeah. which British people don't tend to go to. And as you will know, there's about a million of them. So I'll just then have a look and I'll say, well, what about this? And I'd love to go there and find out about this. And wow.
That's a nice way of putting it, I think, is that you're able to provide more content to the readers that you wouldn't have been able to naturally without that sponsored side of things.
An independent.
Yeah, we can come back to that later.
But I mean, obviously, the readers and viewers are entirely the ones who will judge whether or not it's useful. Whether it adds to their travel enjoyment. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you kind of skipped ahead there, but if we cast our minds back to 25 years ago when you started your career, how have you seen tourism and holiday goers and travel change in the last 25 odd years?
It's all been absolutely fantastic. And I mean, obviously I was very young at the time. No, it has been utterly transformational.
Yeah.
And in three ways, which are very handily just trains and boats and planes. Actually, you might think the trains in Britain aren't great, and in many cases that's the case, but my goodness me, they are far better than they were in 1994, and that is reflected in effectively a doubling of passenger numbers, which actually, if you want to look at the great travel success story of the past 25 years, it's probably trains. Boats, cruising is now really big. I know you've been on the P&O Azura. And, clearly it's not entirely for people who are extremely old.
They're
trying to change the image. But that suddenly changed in 1995, I seem to think, when a company called Airtour, sadly no longer with us, came along and just said, hey, tell you what, we're going to take you on a week's cruise for £400.
Yeah.
And then the same year you had the no-frills revolution starting, and that was EasyJet and Ryanair just coming along when, if you wanted, for example, to go to Scotland from London for the weekend, it would cost you £100. That was an absolute minimum return fare. And Stelios of EasyJet just said, right, £29, don't care if you only go one way when you come back or whatever. And that clearly worked. EasyJet now the biggest airline in Britain by passenger numbers, second safest airline in the world.
Are they really?
Ryanair. Ryanair
just
is the safest.
I love how you can reel these stats off.
Well, Ryan, no, but it's important. I know that you have some issues with flying.
Nervous flyers.
Yes, but it's being mathematical, you see, I just look at the numbers.
Yeah,
and I particularly look at the numbers for number of passengers flown without anybody sadly dying in a crash. And top is Ryanair. And I think last time I worked it out, it was about 1.3 billion people.
Wow, gosh.
And second is EasyJet, and they're 900 million or so. And they are just way ahead of any other airline in the world, which is great.
I once thought it was Qantas who had the safest.
No.
Was that a myth?
No.
Loads of people die.
Maybe because they take the longer haul.
Laura, this is entirely because of a film called The Rain Man.
Oh, how embarrassing.
1980s.
I've been...
Oh, no, every time... It's not you, not just you. Every time I say, Ryanair's safest airline in the world, EasyJet's second safest, somebody's going to tweet or something...
What a cliche.
...and say, no, it's not, it's Qantas.
I apologise for that.
In a film called The Rain Man, the character played by Dustin Hoffman said, oh, Qantas never crash. You only need to go online, thank you, thank goodness we're living in the 21st century, to have a look at the National Library of Australia press cuttings, and you can just search for Qantas fatal crash, and very sadly there's a whole load of them in the olden days before planes stopped crashing, which thankfully they almost entirely have done.
So it's Ryanair, wow. Yeah. I feel bad now. People give them a very hard time, but they're the safest. They should probably make
more.
You
might arrive late, but you arrive safe.
Yeah, exactly.
That should be their new tagline.
We're better arrive alive than dead, late and dead. shared, I think.
Interestingly, no airline, I don't think, has ever sold itself on safety. Maybe they should. Maybe it would be a good honest thing.
Superstition, perhaps.
Kind of nervous travelers.
So then, I guess with all this, it's kind of been the democratisation of travel. So we can all travel now, and it's more of a lifestyle, would you say?
Yeah.
More of a weekend thing.
It's made us all better Europeans.
Yeah.
It really has. I mean, all the propaganda from the EU and all the horrible fuss about Brexit, we're actually much better Europeans than we were, simply because you can go very easily to Barcelona or to Rome or to Dublin or to 18 different places in Eastern Europe that you can neither spell nor pronounce. And that's great. And of course, there's environmental concerns about that. But the fact that there is so much openness that it facilitates people being able to have lifestyles where travel is a really important part of that, whether they're actually shuttling back and forth between Spain and Britain, or whether they're just thinking, yep, every couple of weeks I want to go to a new city. And when I was 18, the only way I could ever go to anywhere in Europe was hitchhiking. I don't mind, I had a very interesting and exciting time, but it was just literally prohibitively expensive. Now, if you are earning the national minimum wage, it's going to take you a morning's work to get a return flight to somewhere in Europe, and it will take you about, when the fares are really low for Australian flights, it will take you a week's work to get a return ticket to Sydney. And you know, in when I was growing up, it would be about 2 years at the average wage.
Really?
To get a flight to Australia. So it's fantastic.
Yeah. Wow. So a wholly positive change, do you think?
Taking apart, if you leave aside the environmental concerns, and even then, all industries are messy. And I think tourism does wonders in spreading wealth around the world. So it's a good thing.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, we have a list here. I've got some questions on my phone.
Oh, okay, right. I'll do quick fire stuff. How about that?
So how have you seen travel journalism change over the course of your career?
Oh, well, I'm not a great person to talk about travel journalism, because although technically I am a travel journalist, I sort of do it a bit different. I've got this slogan, the man who pays his way. I don't take free trips. And so therefore, I'm not kind of part of the mainstream.
I see.
However, I can give you some answers, which is, do you remember telephone directories?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, if you go back to, I think, peak paper travel, it was probably about 2003, 2004. And if you can imagine about four telephone directories stacked one on top of each other, that would be the travel content from the weekend papers, just devoted to travel.
And that 2003, 2004.
Yeah, I mean, that was
that
probably...
That doesn't feel long ago.
No, I mean, it wasn't. And then, of course, everything kind of went online. The Independent went online 3 years ago permanently. And I must say, I haven't had so much fun ever since. Because now, instead of this kind of quite solemn working towards a paper publication every Saturday, we brought out the travel section every Saturday, and that would be your main goal, which is fine and noble, and it was good while it lasted. Now it's just, crikey, an airline's collapsed, better write it up, or oh look, there's this new ferry, I'm gonna go there, be on it, kind of live blog from it, and then write a story about the lovely places it connects you to. So it's very exciting. But you use the term democratization in terms of flying. I think it can equally be used in terms of writing. It's fantastic that there are so many people blogging, and it's great that forums like TripAdvisor exist, because even if you don't necessarily give them your absolute trust, it's still great that they are there and people can write.
I still use it.
Yeah. But so the last 25 years, it's kind of been more of the same, or complete, as in the last 10 years? Has there been more change in the last 10 years than there was in the last?
Yeah, because just the acceleration online. So therefore, if you go back, let's just go back 15 years. The guidebook was probably at its peak as well in terms of sales and everything. And now those have gone, I was going to say, into decline.
Is that do you know a statistic for it?
Have they?
Yeah, well, they most certainly have done, but I think they have now kind of stabilised around a kind of level, a plateau, or the opposite of a plateau, a trough. There's still good, lots of people who want them. The batteries don't run out, or if they, it doesn't matter. But of course, increasingly, and we haven't quite got there yet, I want to be in a world where I've got something like, on my tablet, I've got something like the Lonely Planet guide, but yes. I want to know that it was last updated yesterday by
real-time
researcher somewhere, and that, train no longer runs, and, this new place has opened up. So I don't think anybody's quite cracked the kind of merger between guidebooks and online in a way where you can actually say this is a fantastically valuable thing because it is a rock-solid guidebook that is absolutely up to date, because of course the whole thing about guidebooks is you go and research it by the time it came out, some of the research might be a year old.
I found that a couple of times I've Lonely Planet, I've gone sought out a restaurant, it's not there anymore.
Yes.
Then I've downloaded the chapter and it's been taken out, and I thought,
we were talking about this the other day, citizen science. So it's, you know, in these big scientific experiments these days and global warming, whatever, citizens can just get an app on their phone and update regularly their findings.
Yes.
And I was thinking the other day how great that would be if it just transferred into travel. You know, people could just feel empowered to join something. And maybe that's where online world is kind of headed, and that everyone can join in. It doesn't have to be the experts leading.
Oh, very much so. And I mean, the good thing is that there are ways of verifying, because it's always been this, the kind of traditional guidebook editor would always say, well, how do I know that Claire and Laura actually have done this, or whether they're getting confused with somewhere in a different city? Whereas I can now go on to Street View and say, oh, yes, this fantastic new Lebanese restaurant looks great. And look, I can even go and have a look at the menu and get the prices and everything. So that's good, yes. And but I think it should be, we should be living in a world where you can pay for content which you know is 100% reliable.
Yeah, because
business venture.
I was saying, even with Amazon in the news yesterday, that the number of its 5-star reviews are just fraudulent now. You know, someone's aunt's written them, or someone's sister or dog or something. So I guess that's an issue to work around. So moving into the topic of where travel journalism's sort of how it's changing, when did you notice, or have you noticed, the rise of a travel blogger?
When did it first come into your vocabulary?
Oh, travel
or blagger, as I think a lot of people like to say.
Well, I'm gonna say 3, 4, 5 years. But as a concept, as a kind of, as it were, a self-contained commercial element of travel journalism, I would say that's a kind of a couple of years that this, and of course it merges seamlessly into influencing as a wider industry. It's very good to sort of look into the future and think, well, this is clearly, because the market will determine things, that this is a form of travel journalism which is new and fresh and different and interesting. And of course, we will all, as consumers, put our own value upon it. And so therefore, again, the market, just as it always has done with whether or not people buy a newspaper, it will continue to, the market will sort out who's good and who isn't. So it's good.
That's a nice way to think about it. Yeah.
I think
no one's forcing anyone to read our stuff.
Where the demand is, I guess, and that will sort it all out once and for all, rather than having to have them, you know, any lengthy conversations of quality or relevance. It will just be determined by
the people.
Well, look, anything that, you know, your value is determined by people's, and I'm speaking here about you too, your value is determined by what value other people put on it, and therefore, yes, it's just a market, and it's constantly changing, and it's so exciting, and you always have to stay ahead and just keep going. It's very, very exciting. I've not actually ever been on the staff of The Independent, alarmingly, because obviously when I started, I knew nothing about newspapers. So I I've always been a kind of effectively on a 0 hours contract.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I prefer to do, 0 hours. Yes.
And you can be you don't have to be diplomatic at all. What do you think are perhaps the main differences in between what Claire and I might do and what you might do?
Like you mentioned, you've never been on a free trip. I don't know whether we should explain, probably, that sometimes we go on a press trip where journalists will have been invited out, essentially, on a free trip. And you don't do those. So you only go on trips then that you've pitched for and that you want to talk about. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's even more complicated than that, because I then, on my 0 hours contract, I pay for everything. So every penny is, so my trip to, where have my coat? Yeah, so my trip on this ferry, I will pay for everything, but I'll do it absolutely as cheaply as I can, which is one reason why I'm ending up in Varna in Bulgaria. It's the only cheap flight to anywhere near the Black Sea I could see on that day. So, yes.
Oh, it's more complicated than I thought,
actually. It is a little more complicated.
Well, it's not complicated.
No, but it's a little bit.
I wasn't aware. Is there many of you that do that in terms of...
I don't think so. I think it's just sad little me. Never mind. It's it's an interesting, if lonely, furrow to plough. But, yes, I'm just so intrigued, and I hope you don't mind me kind of drifting into the commercial thing of arrangements of something which I'm not fully
I think it's good for us.
But previously, or at the moment, and let's take the wider printed press, which is still going, and there's excellent travel sections in the Telegraph, in the Sunday Times, in the Times, in the Guardian. People on those papers will go off and do a trip, and they will be paid by the paper. Yep. Not very much. I mean, payment rates haven't really changed in 25 years, which is annoying if you're a writer. Whereas with your model, I understand, you will go off and get all these facilities, but then the supplier of the facilities will pay you, which is different.
Yeah. So how do you stay independent? So I guess that's what we're always asked, is how can you be independent in your reviews or your coverage if you're being remunerated for it?
Because, I don't really have a problem with that, because I would, if somebody was giving me a nice first-class flight and a nice five-star hotel, I would feel obligated to them. And if somebody was also paying me for it, I wouldn't feel any more or any less obligated. So, I don't have a kind of, oh no, that's terrible, you're being paid by the supplier of the property as opposed to the printer of the newspaper. Mm-hmm. So I don't have an issue with that. But
I think it's an important question. And our brother is a journalist as well, and he often asks, how can you be, or how can you stay objective?
Answer that for me.
And the answer is, it's really, really difficult. And you do feel that you're their client in a way, and you feel obligated, and they've paid you, and they've put on a fantastic show, as you probably, with Anna Maria Ireland or anywhere in Florida, they've put so much work into it. So then turn around and say, oh, it's a pile of rubbish, don't go there. It's morally a really difficult thing, and I think as people pleasers we feel, you don't want to be awful about
it. But having said that,
however,
there's nothing in our contract to say that we have to be positive about it, and we wouldn't accept that either.
No, we've actually started to put in our contract that, it will be completely, they don't have any editorial control over what we write. And some places sign off on that, and some people say, our PR would like to have a look at the messaging, and then we'll try and work with them to negotiate our way around that. But I would have, I think I'd be the first to say that there are many influencers out there who will just say, this is amazing, have this flat tummy tea, I've lost 5 stone overnight.
Diarrhea.
They don't care. But like you said, I think, it's a new career path at the minute. And I think it will have to settle in terms of, these things will have to come in. But it's definitely a question I often wonder about. And I feel this, I want to say, that hotel wasn't particularly nice. Or it wasn't perhaps as travellers, as 32
that was an awful flight home somewhere.
It wasn't, and you do wrestle with that. But I think if we wanted to have any longevity in the game, like you in your 25 years... we'd have to demand some independence. And I think, that might mean losing work initially.
I have no problem with saying no to things.
Yeah, but it might, in the short term, it might mean you get less contracts, but you'd hope in the long term, authenticity would kind of win through.
Yeah.
But I think it's, for sure, it's completely different to journalism in that respect, because you do have you're there as discerning journalists, paid by your paper or your title, and you don't necessarily owe anything. We had a story once in Florida.
I'm not sure what you're about to say.
It was a national newspaper, and they were invited to Florida, and a lady turned up on behalf of the newspaper with her partner and had an amazing time. She was dining out, she was sunbathing, but she wasn't doing a lot of photographs, wasn't writing anything down. And the PR fired up when she got home and found out that the editor just sent his PA and she just had a wonderful holiday.
Yeah.
So I would sort of argue on the flip side that I'm sure there's some dirty dealings that happen as well with broadsheets. And just as you can say, or tabloids, you can say, we don't owe you anything, often that can quite mean we owe you absolutely nothing, and then that's exploitative in its own way. You know, a PA can go and have a great holiday, and this poor PR was just, you know, stuck.
Sure, well, that's awful, I'm not qualified to comment on that sort of behaviour,
well,
but all I can say
Simon's
is that the,
like the golden,
yeah, he is, it's very morally upright, yeah.
that the, I just think that the market will find you out, so
yeah,
you know, I presume that she had to write something, or something was written, but perhaps it wasn't as sparkling as
they hoped. Yeah,
as they
either
hoped.
Of you going off and investigating things and actually taking notes—that old trick—and
taking notes.
So on, and photographs. And if I may, going on to the sort of photographs bit, so you take absolutely brilliant pictures, and I'm afraid here's something where I have to say, look, I've moved on. I just take pictures with my smartphone now. I don't carry a big camera around, but you do.
And
that's obviously worthwhile.
Yes.
Yeah,
and I do, I think, because maybe it is this slight idea that blogging isn't professional, this idea to kind of professionalise it and not necessarily prove your worth, but I want to do the best job I can.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's showing that you have skills, almost like you have to prove that you have these skills that you're worth, you know, investing in. So I think there's a lot of bloggers who just use their phones and just create photos of their iPhone, but for some reason Laura
took the extreme of
doing a photography course and then buying.
But I tell you why actually I think it is, perhaps with journalism, is that, you know, you're writing for The Independent, but I think with the blogging thing, obviously I'm writing for the blog, but I'm also have to think about Instagram. And as irritating as it is, a phone snap on Instagram doesn't do particularly well if you want to have a curated and popular Instagram feed. So I think I'm also thinking about, annoyingly, the social media side of things. As much as I'd love
to,
it's additional pressure, perhaps.
Oh well, it might be more pressure, but it means that you've got this multi-channel travel experience, and you're just doing the stuff that's necessary for each bit. Just the same as here we are, we're chatting away for one particular medium, and then you know, you're taking excellent pictures for another medium, and that's just good, isn't it? And
you're on Instagram, aren't you?
Are
you embracing the social media online revolution?
Well, you're big on Twitter.
Oh well, thank you very much.
Twitter.
I think for people of a certain age, Twitter is just about the ideal social media, because, well, certainly in journalism, if you need to find people for whom, you know, very sadly, they're stranded at Mumbai Airport tonight, luckily lots of people, again, probably of a certain age, get into contact with me on Twitter. Somebody did last night and say, hey, guess what? We've just been told by the pilot of our plane that they haven't got enough fuel and we've got to stop on the way back to Bristol Airport. So that's very good. And I get Twitter. I'm not sure that I am the world's greatest Instagrammer, and I think that older writers have to really make an effort and try and get with the programme. It is, frankly, embarrassing not to be more present, I guess.
Okay.
So, that's why it was so nice to meet you two and think, right, okay, so this is the future, this is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Right, catch up.
Yeah, but did you not mention you had a podcast earlier?
We do podcasts here, and that's the great thing is I'm very surprised, because podcasts are a bit sort of early 21st century,
and
it's suddenly come back and people like it.
It's come back around, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Serial, did you hear of Serial, the crime podcast that came out in 2014? That was the resurgence of the podcast,
podcast
called Serial.
This American Life, it's absolutely it's a fascinating trial. You should definitely have a listen.
Sarah Koenig.
She does it.
And I think it's wonderful the way that this is unlocked from the shackles of radio and television transmission time, so you just consume it whenever you want to, which is great.
You're doing the ironing on the train. I think that's what makes
doing the ironing on the train, that's really dangerous.
Such a busy woman.
She's a multitasker, Simon. So I guess, I mean, you kindly said that it's important for writers like yourselves to kind of adopt these new mediums, but I think it's also important for bloggers and travel writers to also acknowledge the work that journalists do. What do you think a blogger could learn from a journalist
from you
as a travel writer?
Oh, look, I'm not going to put myself on a pedestal as a writer in the same mould as well, one of the other very good, let's say Eric Newby, mm-hmm. who sadly passed away, must be 6 or 7 years ago now. He was a proper travel writer. He would go and have lots of adventures. Yeah. I like adventures, but I don't go for a short walk in the Hindu Kush, for example, the name of one of his books. I think the only, and we're sort of straying from where the boundary is between travel journalism, as in Anna Maria Island, it's great, there's an interesting history, and look, this bridge used to be here and it's not anymore, and if you go down the other end of the island, there's this fantastic old prison where you can go and play around and get selfies and so on, and here's the best bar to have your margarita when the sun goes down and feel the sand between your toes. So there's that, which is great, and then there's also all the stuff which happens in travel. Crikey, I just sort of wake up every day thinking I've got no idea what's going to happen today, but it always does. And I suppose for that side of the kind of mechanics, for the consumer advice side, then it's good to have a grounding in almost kind of law, but also the kind of basics of journalism, which is that if you're writing something, if people are saying horrible things about Ryanair or British Airways or Eurostar or whoever, then you are still, you obviously, the first thing you do if effectively is give them a call, sometimes on a telephone, you speak to them and say, I'm running this story in 1.5 hours and I need a response to these assertions about you. So just the kind of, but even then, all it is being fair. I think I think journalistic law and being fair are largely the same thing. So you just shouldn't say horrible things about an organisation without giving the organisation a chance to explain itself. So today I've been saying quite horrible things about quite a big travel company. But, well, of course, because they completely messed up. They upset these poor people. They told them a whole pack of fibs and they have apologised since. But, of course, you can't just say travel company X is a bunch of crooks who should be shut down, partly because you'd be closed down yourself, but also because you have to explain. And I think most people, you probably find this in the travel industry, are good people working hard, generally not getting great pay, but delivering good service.
And so you've been ever so nice about bloggers, and but some journalists really aren't. But do you think then that the two can nicely coexist?
Oh gosh, I think it's great. Look, I'm all
look
in favour of
in the room getting on,
friends.
No, I'm all in favour of competition. It keeps everybody sharp. That's the best thing that's ever happened. It's a proper kick in the backside for travel journalists of the old school. Look, there's all these new people doing great things and taking great pictures and telling good stories, and you know, the more competition the better. It's a great thing. It makes us all sharper and better, so it's great.
The catfish story, you know, put a catfish in a tank of fish and it keeps them all awakened on their
toes.
Fins because they're
on
not,
their fins
because they're not
toes at all.
That's actually nice to hear, because I think when you particularly in the last year, I think we've been exposed to quite a lot of negativity from journalism. It's not personally, but I think the blogosphere, and obviously there are a range of qualities and, you know, people authenticity in it, but I would love to do more press trips with journalists and kind of have that chance to sort of coexist.
I'd love to
sort
travel
of,
with Simon now.
Yeah,
you don't want to travel with me.
How little I can spend.
And
then you can come with us.
My long-suffering family will urge you not to do that. We do end up in quite a lot of scrapes, almost all of which are entirely of my
Oh, really?
And usually end up with us having to hitchhike somewhere inconveniently. And so you definitely don't want to go travelling anywhere near me.
Simon's daughter, Daisy, is here just in the corner. Can you tell us one of the worst scrapes then that's happened?
Oh, crikey. Well,
you've feared for your life, Daisy.
poor Daisy, who... there was the night I failed to book a hotel in Oslo, thinking there's always hotels in Oslo and there were.
We
slept on the floor of the airport.
No.
I think probably the worst was when we were in Baja, California. I'm not sure if you've been there.
No, I've not.
Southwesternmost tip of Mexico. Absolutely gorgeous. We had 100 miles and somehow I misread the bus timetable. So we turned up at the bus station and they said, Senor, it's left an hour ago. We ended up having to hitchhike, but we got a good lift and it was all exciting.
How do your daughters and your wife speak to you after those kind of things?
But look, I mean,
good fun.
Look, here we are. I do try to be nice to them, so we make an uneasy compromise so that in July, August, beginning of August, we are going on a cruise from Athens to Barcelona.
Lovely.
Which is, I like spending time with the family, so I will do it. It wouldn't be my choice of holiday, but they are flying, to get the cruise, they're flying in the day before to Athens. What am I doing? I'm flying from, I'm setting off 3 days earlier because I want to have an interesting time.
You're
going
coming
there.
By horse and car.
No, I'm flying to Dortmund in Germany.
Okay,
I'm
spending
24 hours there, then I'm going flying from there to Sofia, and I've got about an hour to get downtown Sofia and then get the last train to Plovdiv, the European capital of culture. From there I will be heading south across the mountains into Greece, and I've got about 24 hours to get there, and then there's a plane which gets me to Athens 1 minute before midnight in order to meet
them. If you arrive to a fanfare,
is your motivation to do that just you want to do it?
Or have you got work?
I love travelling. I love the serendipity of travelling. But also, I've written a column, a weekly column about travelling. In fact, I've got to write it in a minute. Crikey. But luckily, the more scrapes you get into, the more you've got to write about. Things going wrong is my stock in trade. And luckily, they go wrong quite a lot, don't they, Daisy? Yes.
She looks very impressed.
Yeah.
But it's true, actually. I think I tend to read stories where people have had, they've got sick or something. Yeah. There's an element of drama.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that very much indeed, partly because it's kind of slightly... Yeah, I've got genuinely no idea how I get from Plovdiv across the Rhodope Mountains to Greece.
How are you getting across the mountains?
Well, there's a road which goes most of the way, and then I imagine you just start walking, and if a kind of tractor comes along, you can hitchhike. But it doesn't matter.
But your dad doesn't turn up, what's happening.
Yeah, he's been lost forever.
In Greece a few years ago, I actually got a lift. It was a really, really bad day's hitching. We went off as a family again to the beautiful island of Poros, which is great, but after a couple of days I kind of want to get about a bit, and I go off on a little adventure of my own, and I had such a poor day's hitching that the highlight was getting a lift in the bucket part of a JCB thing, standing there as they drove me across the Peloponnese. Wow. It was quite sad.
Have you got a book yet?
Yeah, you should.
I've done lots of books in the sense of travel guides and
but your
a
own.
Book about no for
no.
Oh, I think
no,
you
no,
should.
No. Like you should come, no. Yeah. Come up in the next few years.
No, I'm constantly, as you are, looking forward.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some great histories of travel being written, and there's great backwards-looking stories, but I'm just always after the next adventure.
The next thing. And because you are famously independent, can you tell us one place you went that you truly despised and you would never, ever return to?
Oh, yeah, I can very, very easily.
Oh, really?
I won't not return there for one very good reason. Sorry, Doha in Qatar.
Okay.
I absolutely love most of the Gulf stopovers. I think Dubai is quite funny. I preferred it in 1994 but undoubtedly delivering good things for a lot of people. Abu Dhabi, I think, is terrific.
Yeah. So we're heading there next month.
Are you? Yeah. Oh, you're going to have a fantastic time. I will send you the 48 hours I did in Abu Dhabi.
Oh, yes, please. Yeah, thank you.
And you can ignore all that advice, if I were you.
Just go on Instagram.
Bahrain, where I was a couple of months ago. Absolutely gorgeous. Very kind of relaxed, great food, great drink, very welcoming. So I love those places. But Doha, I'm afraid, I spoke to a good friend of mine. I said, look, I've got this stopover. Again, it was actually a family trip coming back from the Seychelles. They all wanted to fly non-stop. I wasn't going to do that, so I went back via Doha, and which they greatly enjoyed me not being with them. I said, should I spend 48 hours there? Maybe 24. And he said, no, just spend a morning. And that was quite long enough. Thank
really?
You. I'm going back. They've got a wonderful new National Museum of Doha. But I just felt there was nothing compare.
There.
And I'm afraid the fact that the World Cup is to be held there in 2022 is, well, if I were a FIFA delegate from Switzerland, I stepped off the plane and said, we obviously can't have the World Cup here.
Get
I would have got
back again.
Straight on the next plane to Zurich.
So it was really just, it's very nothingness, it's lack of soul that you just...
I just felt that it was not a place that held anything for me, and I do like everywhere. Yeah. Really, I come from Crawley, so it's pretty low base.
Milton Keynes,
the same opinion.
It was great.
Yes.
So, what's your very best place then?
You obviously, I hate this question, but we have to ask.
Somewhere I've been very recently, I think the place which absolutely stands out was Uzbekistan.
Yes, you very much want to go there.
Now, suddenly, much easier to get to.
Yeah, hopefully. Friend's just been there actually, hasn't she? Her photos were stunning. Really beautiful.
And there are places there which have been kind of mistakenly preserved by state communism because of the Soviet Union.
Accidentally.
It's just utterly stunning and nice people and not too touristy yet. So I like that. And all of Central Asia. But there's loads of places I haven't been to yet. So many places in Africa I haven't been to. I'll just go to Congo next year.
Oh,
do you want to come, Daisy? No, she's shaking her head.
Daisy will be studying. She'll be busy.
She'll come back to the Seychelles.
Where's your favourite place of all? You can't really say that, can you?
No, we can. We've got very, very different tastes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I like the heat and Nora likes.
Oh, I love Scandinavia. It just put me in a Norwegian forest and I think I'd be happy there.
We went to the Finnish lakes last summer and the sun didn't set. We were on a little tiny log cabin and I just thought it was magical.
Yeah, beautiful. There was no Wi-Fi, no electricity.
We had just a traditional sauna. Went in the sauna, jumped in the lake. Jumped in the lake.
There's no one there.
It was 1 a.m. It felt like
Two in the afternoon. It was beautiful.
That's
fantastic.
But the only other place we can agree on is Tokyo, just because it's nothing like anything we've ever been to.
I don't know if it's because, I don't know if I would say it's because I like Tokyo. I think it's more the impact it had on it because it was so different. I think that's what stuck in my mind.
We arrived, the first night we arrived, we had an 8-point-something earthquake.
It was so exciting.
Great, aren't they? We had one of those last year in Greece. We did. We were in the Peloponnese and the room shook in a quite exciting way. You know exactly what it is.
Even though you've never been in one, you know exactly what it is.
Although you have that moment of surrealism, you think, no, it can't be an earthquake. And then you find yourself in one.
So
the future of travel then, if you're a man that looks ahead, what do you think, how travel is going to change, taking into sort of consideration climate change and sustainability and all those things?
Brexit is just an absolute abomination in terms of travel, but we always knew it would be in the sense that I could, the day after the referendum, or indeed the day before the referendum, say these things will absolutely certainly change for the worse from the travel point of view. But we don't know what's going to happen with that. I think that people will there's been an exponential rise, 5% compounded every year in air travel. That will probably continue worldwide. Planes are much, much, much more efficient than they used to be, which kind of, so technology can take the environmental edge off that.
Yeah.
And then, EasyJet are saying within 10 years they will be flying electric planes. They might be. We shall see. And then all you need to do is invent fusion power, which I hope Daisy's going to do because she is a scientist.
Yeah, she's clever.
And then if she can get that sorted out, then we'd have limitless energy and everything would be fine. Yeah. Thank you.
Because you hear, stories of, no one will be able to travel because they'll be taxed so highly because of the environmental impact. But it's nice to say that they're just, because when we were with P&O, actually, they were just changing their engines. So they were these more hybrid sort of engines. Yeah. So why couldn't the same happen
air
travel?
We're humans. We overcome everything that any hurdle we come across, which is probably one of the worst things about ourselves.
Yeah.
So, if we have to invent electric planes, we'll invent electric planes. I just don't think it's that we're not going to travel.
Everything. I mean, media is in transition. Technology is in transition. Yeah. Travel's in transition. And it's great. But the fundamentals of going to new places to place yourself entirely in the hands of strangers who will welcome you to share their food, their culture, their heritage, their landscapes. That's just going to carry on forever, I think.
Yeah, I think I always say that. Exactly.
And what a shame if it didn't, because we had, because of environment. So in terms of, that might be electric planes, which is a nervous flyer, that makes me feel slightly uneasy.
Because there's not going to be any sound.
Yeah, have you utterly silent? I don't know.
I'll try and think of ways that I can convince you that flying is the safest thing.
Well, we have our sister-in-law's an aeronautical engineer and she's not been able to. No.
At Cranfield, presumably?
No, she's actually from Madrid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and smarter than all of us, but she's not been able to convince us as of yet.
No.
Right, oh dear, okay, well I won't, yeah.
And so do you think, if we're, air travel is also increasing 5%, do you think more people will travel and travel until it's just something we all do all
well,
the time?
Well, what you're seeing in India, in China, the biggest countries in terms of population, is that, yes, suddenly it used to be that if you wanted to travel from Delhi to Mumbai, or Bombay as it was, you would have to catch the train, and it would be the only way you could possibly do it. Now, if you're a kind of middling wage earner in India, you can probably fly, and that's going to continue. And thankfully, they're finally looking at high-speed trains, because actually for distances of length, that's what we should be looking at. So, yeah, the amount of travel will expand, which is great, because why should rich Westerners have the monopoly on going to exciting places? And the more that, indeed, rich Westerners do travel to more extreme places, the more wealth will be spread fairly around the world. So it's a good social goods.
Okay, and do you think your job will change in the next, say, another 25 years? In 25 years' time you'll be doing
25
still?
Years' time. Oh, well, look, the only thing I think I can bring to the party is that I have a bit of experience in travel, so therefore something happens, I can think, this is a bit like, let's
you can make connections.
Yes, and what happened last time, and what did we do, and what did we learn, and what did we find, and but it's also a question of speed of response, and that really keeps you on your toes. You want to get the story first, and you want to get it out first, and that's very exciting, and I will continue to try to
and
do
I think
that.
Actually, having spoken to you, when people talk about the differences between bloggers and journalists, I think that really is it, that you are kind of on your toes, reactive.
Yeah.
You know, these trends, these events are happening, and I think maybe blogging is perhaps more...
We're not a news outlet. I was just thinking how impressed I am by all the
statistics. I knew that you would love this, the statistics side of things.
I really do. And that's what I'd love to do. We could have like a reel down our website, breaking news.
Quite a lot of work.
Fed in by Simon.
A hybrid.
Numbers is my comfort zone.
I really like the way you approach it.
Yeah. And to anyone who perhaps doesn't want to be a travel blogger but wants to be a travel journalist, what would you say that they do?
Or travel writer.
I would probably get one of the excellent books. There's Brat Publications, Brat Guides has just brought out a travel writing book Jonathan Lorry.
Really?
That's LORIE. And Lonely Planet have a long-standing guide, and that will tell you kind of lots and lots of stuff. I must say, I wouldn't necessarily encourage obviously my children have far better ambitions than to do this. I think it's a difficult thing to get into. I think it's a difficult thing to set your heart on. Mm, and I kind of detect, Claire and Laura, that you and I have something in common in that we've just sort of stumbled into this by mistake. And
I did go really on holiday until about 4 years ago.
And so that's a very fortunate thing that's kind of brought us here. And I expect we all know in the back of our minds that we could get a real job if we had to.
Plan B.
So
is
don't give up the day job, I think, is probably the best thing, isn't it?
I think that's good advice.
And you're obviously a traveller who likes to be frugal and you like to hitchhike, but your top sort of two travel hacks for someone who wants to take a really cheap holiday break
this summer.
Right. Obviously, don't go during the school holidays because annoying families will
ruin everything.
Increase the demand for it. For good value, just look to Eastern Europe is the place to go. But my top travel hack, which nobody ever takes any notice of, which is good, so I can repeat it again, is just always be the last one on the plane.
I love that because we always say, should you be the first or the last?
Always the last. I go and have a word with the people on the gate and I say, look, I'm just finishing off some work or I've got a call to make.
Yeah.
I'm right here. So just tell me when you need me to get on the plane and as soon as you do, I'll be there. And that means you're the last person on. So I just get on. I've got no idea what it says on my boarding pass. I just think, there's two seats together down the back. I'm going to sit in one of those.
Of course.
And you just get a bit more space.
Sit down and off you go.
Yeah.
Because Claire's very much get on first and then anxiously eye up what's left and wait for the last passenger.
If you know you're the last passenger, you'll
just... I watch you come on and do the last two.
Oh, I can't wait till we're on the same page.
Showdown. Yes. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Simon. I know
such
you've got to go and write your column.
I have. Oh, crikey. I have a look at the time.
I know,
it's been absolutely delightful.
We've overrun.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And next podcast, absolutely no idea.
No, tune in.
Yes, tune
Series
in.
Series 2, number 10.
Number 10. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.